Welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, September 16th. I'm your reader, Kelly Neff. Let's start off by taking a look at the weather for today. Partly sunny, breezy, with a southerly wind at 10 to 20 miles per hour, a high of 85 and a low tonight of 66. Tomorrow, there is a chance of storms with a southerly wind at 10 to 20 miles per hour. The high tomorrow will be 80, the low tomorrow night again 66. Then, on Sunday, there's a chance of storms again with a southwesterly wind at 10 to 20 miles per hour. There'll be a high of 83 and a low of 65. Then on Monday, partly sunny, wind westerly at 5 to 10 miles per hour, a high of 85 and a low of 67. Today's top weather story comes from meteorologist Jan Reihert. It says, with a brief taste of fall last weekend, we've returned to summer-like highs this week. Average temperatures this time of year in Cedar Rapids top out at in the mid-70s, but it is not uncommon to see 80-degree readings during the month. While we do start to see more 60s and even some 50s in September, we typically get about 10 days in either the 80s or 90s throughout the month in Cedar Rapids. So far this year, we are up to 8. On average, our final 80-degree reading isn't until around October 9th, so there still is plenty of time for warmth to stick around. In fact, the latest 80-degree reading in Cedar Rapids was Halloween of 1968. And that's today's top weather story from meteorologist Jan Reihert. Our first story today comes from the front page, and it's a story written by Vanessa Miller of the Gazette. Regents seek $1 million from state for mental health needs. Dateline Cedar Falls. After talking with student leaders over breakfast Thursday about challenges their campuses are facing, Iowa Regents, just hours later, upped their state funding request by $1 million to address mounting mental health needs and to support expanded mental health services. The extra million, which, if granted, would go straight to the board office for allocation across the University of Iowa, Iowa State University, and the University of Northern Iowa campuses, brings the region's total education appropriations ask for the next budget year to $611.5 million. That total represents a $35.7 million bump over the board's current $575.9 million in education appropriations, marking its steepest requested increase in state funding in nearly a decade. Regent Abby Crow said just before the board voted on its legislative funding request for the next budget year, which starts next July 1st, said in recognition of the concerns related to the need for additional mental health services expressed by our student leaders at the breakfast this morning, I'd like to propose an amendment to this request. Crow is one student regent on the 9-member board, currently enrolled at UI and working as a nursing assistant at the UI hospitals and clinics. During yesterday's board meeting, presidents of each of Iowa's public universities spoke about how they would use their cut of the funding increase, should lawmakers grant it, something that hasn't happened in full in years. Excluding the extra $1 million for mental health services, the board is proposing for fiscal 2024 an additional $12 million in new higher education support each for UI and ISU, and $8 million in new higher education funds for UNI. In addition to moderate increases in support for its special schools operations, the board also is asking for $2 million in new funding for UNI's recently launched Community College Collaboration, allowing Iowans who've earned an associate degree from any of the state's 15 community colleges to earn a bachelor's degree from UNI by taking courses online. Prior to its UNI at IACC initiative launch over the summer, which already has increased UNI's transfer members this fall, the Cedar Falls campus has established relationships with 4 community colleges, including Des Moines Area Community College and Indian Hills Community College. If granted, that extra $2 million would enable UNI to add student support services at 4 additional community colleges focused on plugging students into the new program. That's what UNI President Mark Nook told the Regents on Thursday. As for its $8 million more in higher education appropriations, UNI committed to use half to further its teacher training programming, scaling up recruitment of future educators to meet the teacher shortage in Iowa. The other half would go to help further differentiate its tuition from UI and Iowa State, as UNI aims to compete less with those sister institutions and more with other regional institutes in neighboring states that more closely align with its model. Where UNI's resident undergraduate tuition and fees total is only $832 below UI and Iowa State, the difference in rates between public research universities and regional comprehensive institutions in Minnesota, Illinois, and Wisconsin, for example, ranges from nearly $3,300 to $5,500. Nook said, "We want to continue to differentiate ourselves in tuition, and the $4 million that we're asking for, tuition differentiation, is to help us keep our tuition as low as possible. We would really love to keep that flat, if at all possible, but it does depend on having the resources to be able to meet the commitments that we have to our students, to provide them with a high-quality education." Should the state grant UI its full $12 million appropriation increase, UI President Barbara Wilson yesterday said her institution would use a big chunk of that, $7 million, to address the nursing shortage in Iowa. A majority $6 million would go toward renovating and increasing its nursing simulation training space, with another $1 million going toward hiring 10 new faculty, with the goal of adding 48 nursing students a year. Wilson said the hope is to have 208 students per graduating class by 2026, amounting to a 30% increase over 4 years. She said, "We know we can do that with the right funding and the right support on the faculty and simulation side." UI promises to commit the other $5 million in increased appropriations to educating more first-generation students, the growing sector of Iowa's population angling to be the first in their family to attain a post-secondary degree. In discussing its plans for $12 million in new funding, Iowa State also would spend some on supporting first-generation students, about $2 million. Another $4 million would support ISU students pursuing in-demand programs in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. $1 million would support mental health needs and economic growth, and the remaining $5 million would support research and innovation in specific areas of ISU expertise. Also on the front page today is a story written by Marissa Payne of the Gazette, Foundation 2 to renovate Whitwer Building with local federal funds. Dateline, Cedar Rapids. Local nonprofit Foundation 2 Crisis Services is pursuing a more than $3 million renovation of the historic Whitwer Building in downtown Cedar Rapids, largely supported by federal COVID-19 relief funds to serve as its new headquarters facility. Foundation 2 plans to renovate the building at 305 2nd Avenue Southeast. The project will consolidate the organization's 5 existing buildings into one hub to better help people seeking care and to offer trainings. Under this one roof, we'll be able to create a structure where anytime anybody walks into the building, we can offer them the crisis support that we need, according to Development Director Katie Curtis, who said that yesterday. The project is among 2 in Cedar Rapids that received a share of $40 million from Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds, awarded to 24 nonprofit projects using federal COVID-19 relief funds allocated through the Democrat-backed American Rescue Plan Act. Reynolds, who opposed the American Rescue Plan Act, said in a statement that the grant funds, quote, will put Iowa's nonprofits in a better position to serve those in need. Last year, Reynolds called the American Rescue Plan nothing, quote, but a blue state bailout. Democrats say Reynolds' announcement is another in a string of instances where she has touted funding for child care, broadband, and school safety made possible by the federal spending package that she adamantly opposed. Another Cedar Rapids organization called Freedom Foundation received $990,000 to acquire and renovate a building to expand services and support to veterans in need. The state announced Wednesday it awarded $500,000 to the Foundation 2 project. Linn County awarded $2.3 million and the City of Cedar Rapids awarded $250,000, both using ARPA funds. The total project budget still is being ironed out, according to Curtis. After closing on the purchase of the building by October 1st, the renovations are anticipated to take 9 months until approximately next May. Once completed, the building will include office space for more than 100 Foundation 2 employees. It will offer a variety of crisis services and include room to expand. Foundation 2 Chief Executive Officer Emily Blohm said in a statement that the organization appreciates the local and state investments in mental health and crisis services. She said the funds will enhance Foundation 2's ability to provide rapid 24/7 crisis services, increase program collaboration, and offer the most up-to-date training and support for crisis care providers. Blohm said, "We know the need for accessible mental health and crisis support in our communities and across Iowa continues to increase. This is an important part of ensuring we can continue to provide the life-changing and life-saving care we have for over 50 years." Foundation 2 owns the Crisis Center at 1542 2nd Avenue Southeast and an administrative building at 1714 Johnson Avenue Northwest. Those will be sold. The spaces at Tanager Place Clinic at 1030 5th Avenue Southeast and two on Boyson Road in Hiawatha are leased. Foundation 2 will end those leases. Foundation 2 will keep the emergency youth shelter, though, at 3015 12th Avenue Southwest. Curtis said having this new facility will allow Foundation 2 to offer community trainings related to suicide prevention and mental health out of the facility. It also will allow Foundation 2 to better serve a, quote, large population downtown who could benefit from our services, Curtis said, and better accommodate walk-in services. Sometimes people walk into the administration building seeking crisis support, she said, but that's not where the staff is best equipped to respond work. The Whitwer building made sense for Foundation 2 from a cost standpoint with purchasing and renovating, Curtis said, but is also is better suited to connect with people who are in a crisis. She said its proximity to I-380 was a bonus because it will help staff who work on the mobile crisis outreach program to quickly assess the interstate and respond to calls. Curtis said, "It's a great location for us to really publicly be able to remind people who we are and that downtown location we know is a really premier spot for people to be able to see us and stay connected to us." Curtis was not able to provide information about what would happen to the current Whitwer Building tenants. The facility is occupied by White Star, County Underground, and some office users. Lexi Coberly, the executive director at the Freedom Foundation, said the grant money will allow the nonprofit to expand its services and support for veterans by facilitating a move next year to a larger space. Coberly said a wonderful supporter purchased the former local Craft Ale House last fall and donated the building at 4001 Center Point Road Northeast to the Freedom Foundation, which is responsible for renovations. Coberly said the foundation already has raised some money, and the addition to the $990,000 in state grant funding will allow the group to outright purchase the building and provide a permanent location to help veterans. The nonprofit provides programs and services for veterans, including a food pantry, employment placement program, a temporary housing and shelter program for homeless and displaced veterans, a Veterans Emergency Financial Assistance Fund, and a free weekly meal. Last year, she said, the Freedom Foundation saw 4,400 veterans and members of the public pass through its doors and assisted 95 veterans with emergency financial assistance. The group also paid for hotel rooms for 10 veterans close to being homeless and provided 26,000 pounds of food and personal hygiene and household items to more than 1,200 veterans. Coberly said, "We have grown over 25% since then, so we are rapidly increasing the number of veterans that are joining us and just the amount of items and food that's going out the door." The group has reached capacity, serving about 80 veterans a week at its Thursday luncheon, whereas the new space will allow the foundation to serve more than 100 veterans inside and 50 outside at a time, according to Coberly. She said, "We're also looking to expand and do family movie nights and that type of stuff to encourage younger veterans and active duty members to come down and join us." Renovations already have begun, and Coberly said the foundation anticipates moving to the new location in early February. The front page is loaded with stories today. Here's one written by Grace King of the Gazette. CR's new City View Magnet High School's looking for students. Dateline, Cedar Rapids. Parent information meetings are scheduled this month for families interested in sending their rising 9th and 10th graders to City View Community High School, a new project-based magnet school in the Cedar Rapids Community School District. The meetings, which are open to the public, will be September 22nd in the auditorium of McKinley STEAM Academy at 620 10th Street Southeast, and then September 26th at the Cedar Rapids Public Library at 450 5th Avenue Southeast. Both meetings will run from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. Trace Pickering, the former director of Iowa Big, said a lot of kids have great experiences in traditional high school, and it's the right place for them. There are some kids that, for whatever reason, it isn't. I'm excited the district is offering another choice for those families. It's really about what kind of learning environment feels best for you. Iowa Big is a concept championed by the Gazette's parent company as the community rebuilt after the historic 2008 flood. It is a part-time program where high school students team up with businesses to work on projects. Pickering, who retired from Iowa Big earlier this year, is a part-time consultant for City View. City View students will be working with the Edgenuity online learning program, which is what students use in the Cedar Rapids Virtual Academy. Online learning at City View, however, will be done primarily in the classroom, where teachers can answer questions as needed. This frees up teacher time to focus on the project-based learning aspect of the program. Pickering said, "The advantage we see is if a student has online courses, the computer does the heavy lifting." A school day at City View would include time for online learning, community and project-based learning, and seminars. The online learning at City View will be driven deeper through project-based learning. Pushing students further in their knowledge and learning will happen through that lens, said Daniel DeVore, who's the principal of the High School Magnet Program and Iowa Big. He said, "I want City View to be for all students in Cedar Rapids. A student that might be bored in their classes and wants to explore what's out there." He went on to say, "We know there are some ties to friend groups and things like that will make it hard to leave a traditional high school experience, and we get that. The goal is to build those same ecosystems in our buildings." Earlier this week, students in the Iowa Big program pitched entrepreneurial ideas to community members and partners from around Cedar Rapids. Pitch sessions like those are conduits for community and business leaders to network and build relationships with each other and with students, who, according to DeVore, who said, "We've learned a lot in 10 years at Iowa Big." Pickering said, "It's going to be similar in that we want students at City View out in the community, engaged in projects they're interested in. City View, quote, can make a big contribution," said Pickering, in helping Cedar Rapids businesses find qualified workers who are willing to stay in the city. So many students, for whatever reason, don't think there's any opportunity here. We just want to make sure they understand in this city there is almost any career they would want. School officials are looking in downtown Cedar Rapids as a location for the school. They are beginning to recruit up to 200, primarily rising 9th and 10th graders, to enroll in the 2023-24 school year. The school eventually will have 400 9th to 12th graders. If more than 200 students are interested in attending next fall, the district will use a lottery system to select students for the program. On the Iowa Today page, we have a story written by Grace King of the Gazette. Iowa City Schools Ombudsman reports on the first year. Dateline, Iowa City. In the first year of the Iowa City Community School District's Ombudsman Office, Janet Abiho Parker has been an advocate for fair treatment and equitable processes for students, staff, and families. Abiho Parker said it is a highly rewarding role, giving her the chance to connect with students and the community in a positive and collaborative way. During a school board meeting earlier this year, Abiho Parker presented a report on the office's first school year. She said it can be a very difficult and significant thing to reach out for assistance or help, especially to a brand new position, resources, and offices. Abiho Parker said, expressing appreciation and gratitude for those who took a chance. She reported 100 people approached her with 138 topics of concern during the school year, adding she is working to build trust and relationships by establishing the office's integrity and credibility. The majority of the office's contacts were with school district employees. 36% of the contacts were with a student's parent or guardian, and 3% were from students themselves. Some of the concerns include administrative issues, such as decisions of administrators and application of rules and quality of services. Constituent relationships, such as communications, enrollment, or transfers, or discipline. Discrimination and harassment or bullying. Relationships such as supervisor effectiveness, discipline, and performance reviews. Peer and collegiate relationships such as respect and treatment. Career development such as involuntary change of assignment or career development, coaching, and mentoring. In working through the concerns, Abiho Parker said she employed conflict resolution, informal mediation, and gathering and clarifying information. Those visiting the office, she said, filled out a feedback survey. One of the survey questions was, if you had not contacted the ombuds for assistance, what might have happened instead? Responses included, remain unsatisfied, address directly through human resources, file a lawsuit or formal complaint, or leave the district. School board member J.P. Clausen said, I hope our numbers don't grow a lot. I hope a lot of people don't have a concern for an ombuds. But what would have happened if they didn't contact the office are all really bad things we don't want to happen. He added, we've got a place for folks to be heard, but you're not just there for people to feel listened to. You're there helping them navigate their concern and solve a problem. School Board President Ruthina Malone said feedback shows, quote, that people are feeling heard and validated. Malone said, that's one of the most important aspects of this role. We want our people, students, parents or guardians, and employees to feel support as they work through any issue they bring to our office. The Iowa City School Board prioritized creating an ombudsperson position in the district a couple of years ago as part of its 9 administrative action steps toward diversity, equity, and inclusion. Iowa City is one of few K-12 school districts in the country with an ombudsperson. Moving on to the Insight page, we have today's Gazette's editorial, which is headlined, A Welcome End to Seclusion. The Gazette says, although it's unfortunate it took an investigation by the Department of Justice to steer the Cedar Rapids Community School District in the right direction, we applaud the settlement agreement announced this week that would end the use of seclusion in the district's schools. The agreement also will limit the use of restraints. The district will revise its restraint practices and procedures while reporting all uses of restraints and offering students counseling. The district will provide appropriate training for staff, adopt policies and procedures to assess suicide risk and other crisis intervention, and hire administrators to oversee the use of restraints. The Justice Department found that Cedar Rapids schools repeatedly and inappropriately secluded and restrained students with disabilities, some as young as kindergartners, in violation of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Subdued and restrained students lost hundreds of hours in instructional time. Assistant Attorney General Kristen Clark of the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division said in a release Monday, as reported by the Gazette's Grace King, that students with disabilities should not be subjected to discriminatory and abusive seclusion and restraint practices that deny them equal access to education. When schools isolate and unlawfully restrain children with disabilities rather than provide them with the supports needed for success in the classroom, they violate the promise of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Clark said, "Our agreement puts the Cedar Rapids Community School District on a path to significant institutional change and reform. We agree with the department's assessment and welcome reforms." It was the Gazette's Aaron Jordan who reported in January 2020 that 237 Cedar Rapids Elementary students were restrained in just the first month of the 2019-2020 school year. That was four times as many as were restrained during the same period in 2015-16. The district did not disclose details on why students were secluded and restrained. The Department of Justice inquiry began later that year with investigators visiting 10 Cedar Rapids Elementary and Middle Schools. Reporting all instances of restraint for evaluation is an important step, but training will be key to studying that data while creating appropriate behavior for intervention plans for students. We're hopeful that the district is on a better path, but it will take training and hard work to reduce seclusion numbers. We've seen it happen in Iowa City, where the district reached an all-time low in the number of times restraints and seclusion were used during the 2021-22 school year. The Department of Justice will be watching to make sure Cedar Rapids stays on the right path. And that's today's Cedar Rapids Gazette editorial. We have one community letter today, and that is from Richard Zurbach of North Liberty. It says, "Let's secure Grassley's retirement from Senate." He says, "Senator Chuck Grassley is 89 on Saturday, older than most residents in senior centers. Few remember his first major act. He reported that a military toilet seat cover cost about $640. Lots of publicity. Years have passed, and he has changed. Recently, he voted against controlling pharmaceutical costs. It's reported that he received more than $1 million from pharma companies. The result? Many senior citizens and others do without medication. He delayed processing one Supreme Court justice candidate, then acted rapidly to pass two different candidates. Result? The unbalanced court quickly started depriving women of their first of many rights. Grassley seems unable to make up his own mind and only does what his party leaders let him do. Yet, he brags about visiting all counties. True, except he only visits with small Republican groups, afraid to even talk with a mixed group like at the Iowa State Fair. Let's reward Grassley by securing his retirement. Many employers retire employees at 65 years of age. IRAs must start withdrawing by age 72. Let's replace Grassley with Michael Franken. Born and raised on a farm, Franken also served as an admiral overseas and in Washington. He's young enough, yet experienced enough to play a strong role representing and supporting Iowa's needs in Washington during these threatening times. And that is a community letter from Richard Zurbach of North Liberty. You're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, September 16th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. We'll start with what the Gazette calls their other notices, the shorter notices. From Cedar Rapids, Robert G. Adams, age 74, died Wednesday, September 14th. The Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids will be in charge of those arrangements. From Independence, John G. Lays, age 94, died Tuesday, September 13th. Assisting the family will be the Rife Family Center Funeral Home and Crematory in Independence. Also from Independence, Catherine L. Ratliff, age 81, died Tuesday, September 13th. The Rife Family Center Funeral Home and Crematory in Independence will be in charge of those arrangements. From Shellsburg, John DeClotz, age 79, died Wednesday, September 14th. In charge of the arrangements there will be the Phillips Funeral Home of Vinton. From Vinton, Dorothy May Rouse, age 96, died Wednesday, September 14th. The Van Steenhuis Tehan Funeral Home of Vinton will assist the family. In the longer obituaries, Barbara Ann Smejkal, S-M-E-J-K-A-L, age 89 of Cedar Rapids, passed away Tuesday at Unity Point Health St. Luke's Hospital. Entrusted with arrangements is Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home, and services will be held at a later date. Memorials may be made to Camp Courageous of Iowa. James Jeffrey Grafton of Cedar Rapids passed away Wednesday, September 14th at Mercy Medical Center following complications of lung cancer. Friends may visit with the family on Monday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Tehan Funeral Home. Burial will be at 1:30 p.m. Monday. F. Gordon Lane, age 91, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Tuesday, September 13th. Funeral services will be at 1:30 Monday afternoon, September 19th, at the Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services. Visitation will be from 2 to 4 p.m. Sunday at the funeral home. Burial with military honors will be at the Mount Calvary Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Lloyd Lee Banks, age 86, of Cedar Rapids, died Monday, September 12th at his home from a short illness. Services will be private. Interment will be at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. The Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home is in charge of the arrangements. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to your local Humane Society. Carolyn Lee Fox, age 75, of Cedar Rapids, died Tuesday, September 13th at Unity Point Health St. Luke's Hospital following a short illness. The Tehan Funeral Home is serving the family. Constance Jean Cox, age 79, of Hiawatha, passed away Monday, September 12th at Mercy Medical Center. A visitation will be held at St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Catholic Church from 9:30 to 11 o'clock Saturday morning, September 17th. A funeral mass will follow the visitation and will begin at 11 a.m. In lieu of flowers, memorials can be directed to St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Catholic Church. Kate Louise Rose, age 72, passed away Saturday, September 10th at the Oldorf Hospice House in Hiawatha. Celebrate her life with us from 2 to 4 p.m. Sunday, September 25th at the Lester Burrish Family Community Wellness Center at 855 Palisades Road in Mount Vernon. There will be a short program beginning at 2 p.m. Memorials can be directed to the Extraordinary Woman Award at 731 Palisades Road in Mount Pleasant or the Southeast Lynn Community Center at 108 South Washington Street in Lisbon. Mary Regina Duggan, age 92, of Manchester, passed away on Thursday, September 15th at the Regional Medical Center in Manchester. Family will greet friends and family from 9 to 10:45 Saturday morning, September 17th at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Manchester, with a funeral mass following at 11 a.m. and the Reverend Gabriel Anderson officiating. Burial will take place at Calvary Cemetery in Ryan, Iowa. Terry M. Branscombe, age 67, of Marengo, passed away Saturday, September 10th at the University of Iowa Hospitals in Iowa City. A private family memorial service will be held at a later date. The Kloster Funeral Home of Marengo is assisting the family with those arrangements. Alan Lee Reddick, age 77, of Walker, Iowa, passed away Tuesday, September 13th at Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids. The family will greet friends and family from 1 to 3 p.m. Sunday, September 18th at the Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Central City. A funeral service will be held at 10:30 Monday morning, September 19th at the funeral home, with Reverend Sean Smith officiating. Burial with military honors will follow at Coggin Cemetery in Coggin, Iowa. And Mary D. Shroop, age 91, of Marion, passed away Wednesday, September 14th, at the Views of Marion. Visitation will be held from 10 to 11 a.m. Monday at the Lutheran Church of the Resurrection. Funeral service will be held at 11 o'clock Monday at the church, with the Reverend Jeff Frobner officiating. Family will greet friends an hour prior to the service at the church. Burial will follow at Oak Shade Cemetery in Marion. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion is assisting the family. Memorials in Mary's memory may be directed to the Hospice of Mercy or the Alzheimer's Association. Turning our attention now to the sports page, we have one story here about hockey. The Iowa Heartlanders of Coralville signed two players and made a trade this week. Iowa signed forward Gus Van Ness and defenseman Skyler Pacheco to contracts, and the Heartlanders traded for forward Brendan Robbins from the Maine Mariners in exchange for Josh Koplinger and future considerations. Iowa now has 20 players on contracts for the season, with the home opener coming up October 21st. It's Friday, that means high school football, and here's the Gazette's look to the games that are of a complete interest coming up tonight. Cedar Rapids Xavier at North Scott in a battle of 3-0 teams. Third-ranked Xavier has rattled off three consecutive wins over quality competition, but this probably marks the Saints' toughest test of the regular season. The sixth-ranked Lancers are the last team to top Xavier in the regular season, which was 20-8 in Week 4 last year. A pair of 2-1 teams will meet in Des Moines as City High goes to West Des Moines Dowling. This game was 6th-ranked City High's launch pad last season. The Little Hawks knocked off Dowling at Bates Field, and that vaulted them to a 10-2 campaign that took them all the way to the state semifinals. Expect an aerial show from both sides tonight. The 2nd-ranked Maroons have Iowa City Regina is at Minneapolis tonight. Let the fun begin in Class 1A District 5. Take Loaiza Muscatine out of the equation, and the other five teams are a combined 14-1. And that one loss, Regina to Williamsburg, certainly isn't a bad one. This game and the battle of unbeatens between Wilton and Durant will provide an early peek at what the pecking order will look like. Marion is at DeWitt Central tonight. Marion's stock rose immeasurably last week. After suffering lopsided losses in their first two games, the Wolves put it all together with a surprising 38-14 handling of then 3A-ranked Benton Community. The number 8 Sabres are scoring at a 41.7-point clip. Unbeaten Cedar Rapids Kennedy will host winless Cedar Rapids Jefferson. 5th-ranked Kennedy's special teams were exemplary in last week's win over Washington. The Cougars can play defense, too, as their 8.3 points per game allowed will attest. 2-1 Cedar Rapids Prairie is at 0-3 Bettendorf tonight. Of all the happenings in 5A football so far this fall, perhaps the biggest surprise is the fact that Bettendorf is 0-3. The Bulldogs surrendered 372 rushing yards and 4 touchdowns to Muscatine's Ty Kozad last week, and that has to have number 8 Prairie's Mikel Taylor envisioning a big night of his own this week. 3-0 Mount Vernon will be at 2-1 center Point Urbana, and the secret is out. Number 4 Mount Vernon is very good. The Mustangs sandwiched a couple of shutout wins around their memorable rivalry game over Solent in a win and have soared up the rankings. This doesn't appear to be a cakewalk, though. Center Point Urbana has explosive capabilities, scoring in the 30s in both of its victories. There was a couple, or were a couple, of big cross-country meets held yesterday, one girls, one boys, at the Cascade Invitational. In the girls' race, first place went to Monticello. Tipton was number 2, Marion was 5th, Benton Community 7th, and Iowa City Regina 8th. In the boys' race at Cascade, Marion was the winner, and he actually had the individual champion, Jedediah Osgood. Tipton finished 2nd, Regina was 3rd, and Benton Community was number 10. The new high school volleyball rankings are out for the week. In Class 5A, Pleasant Valley remains the number 1 team in the state. Iowa City Liberty is number 2. Linmar is 14th. In Class 4A, Cedar Rapids Xavier is the number 1 ranked team in the state, with Marion right behind at number 2. At number 6 is Clear Creek Amana. In Class 3A, Des Moines Christian tops the state rankings. Lisbon is number 6, Wilton is 12th. While in Class 1A, North Tama sits on top, with Springville 2nd and Riverside 15th. Back to news now as we find a story written by Grace King of the Gazette. District Leader Bush taking medical leave. Dateline, Cedar Rapids. Superintendent Noreen Bush of the Cedar Rapids Community School District is taking a medical leave beginning Monday. Bush was diagnosed with cancer 2.5 years ago while serving as superintendent of the 16,700-student school district. School Board President David Tominski said in a message to the community Thursday, "Noreen established a theme of love and care for our district to begin this school year, and we, as a school district and broader community, fully support her with all our love and care as she takes this important time to focus on her cancer journey." Bush will continue her title as superintendent throughout her medical leave, according to a news release from the district Thursday. Over the summer, Bush participated in a cancer clinical trial in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where she underwent cellular therapy. In a message to families in June, Bush wrote that she hoped to come back from Pittsburgh, quote, "with a rebooted immune system that will approach cancer cells very differently from the chemo and immunotherapies I have experienced." In that same message, Bush said she considers herself, quote, "very fortunate to have had ongoing treatment from an amazing medical team at Hall Perrine Cancer Center in downtown Cedar Rapids." On the Iowa Today page is a story written by Trish Mahaffey of the Gazette. Medical examiner says 26 stab injuries caused death. Dateline Cedar Rapids. A deputy Iowa medical examiner testified Thursday the 26 sharp force injuries, stabbings, in Carrie Davis's head, back, torso, arms, shoulder, and legs were sufficient to cause her death. Dr. Jonathan Thompson is a forensic pathologist who testified that the 29-year-old Marion woman, who was 5 feet 5 inches and weighed 101 pounds, lost 400 milliliters of blood that went into her chest cavity from 2 injuries that penetrated her right lung. She would have about 3 liters of blood in her body, so if she would have lost 1 liter, she could die from the severe loss of blood. Carrie Davis died about 7 days before the autopsy, October 4, 2017, Thompson said. The amount of blood in her lungs could have been greater at the time of her death, he said. Thompson said more blood was on her clothing, the carpet, and the mattress at the scene, and the carpet roll in which her body was concealed. The carpet roll was on a utility trailer until October 2nd, when Marion police found her body. 30-year-old Greg Davis, her ex-boyfriend, is being retried this week in Linn County District Court on a first-degree murder charge. He was granted a new trial in 2020 when the Iowa Supreme Court overturned his 2018 jury conviction. In a 4-3 opinion, the justices ruled that the trial judge erred by not including an instruction to the jury on Davis's insanity defense. In this trial, Davis waived his right to a jury trial, choosing a bench trial, meaning 6th Judicial District Judge Sean McPartland will determine the verdict. Davis is again claiming insanity or diminished capacity in his defense. The autopsy showed Carrie Davis was stabbed in the upper back 7 times and had 2 head injuries, Thompson said while identifying the autopsy photos in court. 2 stab wounds penetrated the right lung. Other wounds were found in her chest, shoulders, sides, arms, hands, and thigh. Some of Carrie Davis's family, who are attending the trial, teared up, and some left the courtroom during Thompson's testimony and when the photos were displayed. Thompson said the lack of Carrie Davis's right hand, palm, and fingers had injuries consistent with defensive wounds. The injuries to her body came from multiple directions, vertical, horizontal, and oblique, which meant she and possibly her attacker were moving at the time, he said. Thompson couldn't determine what weapons were used, except that it had a sharp edge and didn't have to necessarily be a knife. Carrie Davis had no natural diseases, he said. Her heart was normal weight, and she had no coronary artery disease or other heart abnormality. Her lungs were healthy. The alcohol or ethanol in her system was 0.18 grams, which is below the legal driving limit, and the breakdown of nicotine in her system didn't contribute to her death. She also had 690 nanograms of amphetamine and 4,700 nanograms of methamphetamine in her system, which Thompson said is high and showed that she probably had used meth the day of her death. Thompson added that any amount of meth in someone's system can be toxic because it can cause cardiac arrhythmia, which is an irregular heartbeat that can lead to a heart attack. The amount of meth found in Carrie Davis, he said, was concerning, but she died from the 26 sharp force injuries. Meth, in this case, didn't cause her death. No one injury caused her death, according to Thompson, but rather a collection of all the injuries. He determined the manner of death was homicide. On cross-examination, Alfredo Parrish, Greg Davis's lawyer, questioned Thompson about the cause of death, challenging his qualifications regarding the toxicity of drugs. He said Thompson had contradicted himself because he admitted the amount of meth in Carrie Davis's system was toxic. The defense plans to have an expert testify that Carrie Davis died from a meth overdose and was already dead before she was stabbed, which would mean Greg Davis didn't cause her death. At one point during Parrish's cross-examination, he asked the court for a mistrial when Thompson said he had received some personal and medical history from Carrie Davis's mother and sister, but didn't include that in his autopsy report. Parrish said that information should have been disclosed to the prosecution and defense. Thompson said his office does not usually attach that kind of information to an autopsy report, but that Parrish could get it from the state medical examiner's office. Judge McPartland called a recess and asked Thompson to email that information to Assistant Linn County Attorney Mike Harris, who was prosecuting the case, so he could share it with Parrish. Parrish withdrew his mistrial motion and continued questioning Thompson, pressing him on the amount of meth in Carrie Davis's system, saying it was a lethal level. In a race, Parrish asked, wouldn't the meth have killed her if a fatal arrhythmia happened before stab injuries because a stabbing death would take longer? Thompson agreed, but said there is no information to indicate those factors started at the same time. On redirect by the prosecutor, Thompson repeated his conclusion that 26 stab injuries is what caused Carrie Davis's death. There's a story from the Gazette with various contributors. Green State Credit Union cuts 42 jobs. Dateline, North Liberty. North Liberty-based Green State Credit Union said it has instituted a reduction in force effective immediately that eliminated the positions of 42 employees across the organization. Citing decreased demands for loans, Jim Kelly, the credit union's chief marketing officer, said in an email to the Gazette yesterday that most of the workers affected were in the mortgage lending or commercial banking divisions. He noted that was less than 5% of Green State's current workforce. Kelly wrote, "This action was necessary due to the market corrections currently taking place that have a direct impact on Green State's operations." He said the employees impacted by this move have been given a severance package, as well as extended insurance coverage. After a July increase by the Federal Reserve, national interest rates today are at a range at 2.25 to 2.5%. The Fed has indicated another hike will come later this month, possibly as much as 0.75%. As a result, the average rate for a 30-year fixed mortgage nationwide has climbed to slightly over 6%. Applications for mortgages have dropped in response. Kelly said the staffing situation and action was unrelated to Green State's decision last month to drop plans to buy Premier Bank in Omaha. Regulatory opposition was given at the time as the reason for ending the proposed acquisition, according to American Banker. Another story along those same lines, written by the Bloomberg News, that says Bed Bath & Beyond has started to close down and liquidate 56 stores as part of a wide-ranging turnaround plan, which the troubled retailer is betting will rekindle some of its lost appeal with U.S. shoppers. The closings, many of which are happening in the upper Midwest, New York, and New Jersey, where its locations are more densely packed, are the first round of what ultimately will total about 150 stores. In Iowa, the retail chain's website indicates its Waterloo and Dubuque venues are the only stores in this state to be closed. Along with job cuts for 20% of its workforce, the changes are aimed at slashing costs at a business that has burned through cash and lost customers as it turned away from national brands. To stay afloat, it has paired the cuts with a new $500 million line of credit secured late last month that it plans to use, in part, to get back on good terms with suppliers. Adding to the uncertainty surrounding the company's future, Chief Financial Officer Gustavo Arnall died by suicide days after the company had laid out its turnaround plans to investors. Company spokeswoman Julie Strider said in an email, "We will continue to review our portfolio where it makes sense to profitably support our customers and business." Polio has been in the news recently, and there's a story in today's Gazette that says, "Is polio a serious concern?" It's actually a message written by the American Academy of Pediatrics. Question: I've read about polio appearing again in the U.S. Should I be worried about my kids? Answer: it was reported over the summer that an unvaccinated man in New York got polio and has developed paralysis, and there is evidence of the virus circulating in the state's wastewater. The patient reportedly contracted a form of polio that can be traced back to the live poliovirus used in the oral vaccine. This version of the vaccine has not been used in the U.S. since 2000. Health officials said the virus probably originated overseas in an oral vaccine distributed there. People who are vaccinated should not be concerned. We have not seen polio in the United States since the 1970s and 80s, and polio was declared eliminated from the Western Hemisphere in 1994. We know the polio vaccine works. Polio is caused by a virus that affects infants and young children more often than other age groups. Most cases of polio are mild. Paralytic polio causes muscles to be paralyzed, leaving some people physically impaired for the rest of their lives. Before the polio vaccine, widespread cases of paralytic polio in the U.S. led many parents to be worried about letting their children swim in public pools or gather at movie theaters or parks. Since the mid-1950s, the polio vaccines have led to a dramatic decline, with over a 99% reduction in polio cases around the world. Polio can spread through contact with stool from an infected person or droplets from a sneeze or cough. It is transmitted from contact with fecal matter within 1 to 2 weeks after a person is infected with polio. An infected person can spread poliovirus to others before they have symptoms. The virus can live in an infected person's stool for weeks. People can contaminate food and water if they touch it with unwashed hands. It is hard to detect polio, they say, or prevent it from spreading. Children who are not immunized are at risk. Most people with polio infection will have no symptoms. Infrequently, polio can cause paralysis in the arms and legs or even death if muscles involved in breathing are paralyzed. Symptoms may begin with a low-grade fever and a sore throat about 6 to 20 days after being exposed to the virus. Children also may feel pain or stiffness in their back, neck, and legs for a brief time. Paralysis causes severe muscle pain. A person is most contagious 7 to 10 days before symptoms occur and can infect others for another 7 to 10 days. No treatment is available. Some children fully recover from polio, but others are disabled for a lifetime or may die from the disease. The best protection is the polio vaccine. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, September 16th. I'm your reader, Kelly Neff. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thank you for listening.